This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Before the EPA, or the Environmental Protection Agency, was created in 1970, Americans were surrounded by lead, from paint and pipes to the tailpipes of their cars. Today, that toxic legacy has dramatically declined, and the evidence is surprisingly personal. It's in our hair.
University of Utah geology professor Ture Serling joins us to discuss new research showing how century-old locks of hair saved from family scrapbooks reveal a stunning drop in lead exposure. It's a powerful reminder that environmental regulations don't just change policy, they change public health. Ture Serling, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Nice to be talking with you.
So let's start off for listeners who actually may not know. How does hair capture and preserve chemical signatures like lead over time?
In two ways it does. One is that hair, of course, is produced, you know, from basically from your circulatory system. So that's a small amount of lead that it might record that was in your blood. But over time, hair actually accumulates other things from the environment. So, and one of those things that in this case that we studied was lead. And lead is kind of floating around in the environment, and it picks up on your hair.
So it sounds like hair is a very powerful scientific record, but I'm curious as to what led you to study lead levels in preserved locks of hair in the first place.
I was talking to one of my colleagues who is up at the University of Utah and then also in the Family and Consumer Studies, Ken Smith. And he was working on a project where they were working on octogenarians, older people, and their descendants. And I said, well, you know, is it possible that perhaps some of them might have old hair from their childhood, and we could compare their modern and old hair in say, baby hair? And so they attached that to their questionnaire when they were recruiting new people into this study. And it turns out quite a number of them did have samples. And so that was our sample selection, was people who had not only the older people in this study, but this study also included their children and their grandchildren. So we have quite a range of times that we were able to get samples from.
So your samples span from about, what, 1916 to 2024? That's a long time.
Yes.
Okay. And it's interesting to think about, I think my mother saved maybe baby's first haircut in our scrapbooks. But this is an interesting point because now after doing all this research, you know this, but you wouldn't think that there would be a lot of lead in, you know, maybe it would take a lifetime to accumulate. So if you saved your hair from your, you know, 60-year-old haircut, which I would think not many people did, that would show a lot more accumulation.
You've been cutting your hair all your life. So
yes.
So hair grows at about 1 inch every 2 months. So maybe 6 inches a year. Hair that the three of us in this conversation have sort of, you know, the longest hair that we have has been recording a longer time than the hair at the base.
Right.
Of course, for a 1 or 2 year old, your first haircut, you know, that's your lifetime exposure.
Okay. Yes, that makes absolute sense. But also, you know, a baby has not been around very long to accumulate lead in the system. And I guess that's what I'm picturing as we're, you know, before there was unleaded gasoline, for example, or when there were lead pipes, or when we use lead-based paint. Do we accumulate it in our system, or does it immediately go through to our hair follicles?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer exactly to your question. But what I think you'd be asking would be, what is the residence time, or what is the average amount of time that certain things stay in your body? And most of them are actually, you know, not real long. And then you'd also have the question of, well, what about the concentration in your blood? Because some of things might get deposited and stored away permanently And your blood might not be able to restore them very frequently, but you know your red blood cells and your serum blood don't have that particularly long a lifetime. So if you get off of these toxic metals, the concentration in your hair would go down. But what we're seeing in the hair is not mostly what your body, it was in your body, but what actually is in the outside environment that you're being exposed to. So, and people have shown that, you know, a better measure of the, you know, danger to an individual is the concentration in their blood. But of course, we can't go back and get samples of blood from 100 years ago. And, you know, your mother didn't save your, you know, your blood from your the first time you bled, but she did maybe save your first haircut.
Lynn made a very interesting point about in the way back days, there was leaded paint, there was lead in our gasoline, probably lead in coal-fired plants, things of that nature. I want to understand how analyzing lead in the hair samples maybe helps us better understand historical exposure to pollution. I mean, long before there was an Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to, and we would be actually very interested in getting a much larger data set than we have. But it certainly, I recall in the 1950s and the 1960s, before we had the Environmental Protection Agency, there were, you know, much higher levels of pollution from all sorts of things. And certainly in Salt Lake Valley, we also had several smelters that were important, certainly in the 30s, 40s. One of the main ones closed down in the late 1940s, but there was still active smelting going on, and there's still metal refining going on in the United States today. So it's something that we have to go. One of the things that I think is really important to remember in this and all of these other related issues is that when we, this study shows that it really took 20 or so years after EPA was established and we put in these regulations before we could see a significant drop in the lead concentrations. And we've seen that in other things as well. We saw that with the acid rain problem. And so I think it's really important to remember that it takes a long time to clean these problems up. And it also means that some of the younger generations don't realize how polluted it was. And we don't want to go back to those conditions. And I think the people who don't remember how messy the room was when now they're confronted with a nice, clean living room and want to leave a little pile of this, that, and the air, how unpleasant it can be when you have those really high levels. So we don't want to go back to those previous high levels of contamination.
Well, I know I'm going to paraphrase this, but I think if you don't examine the past, you're doomed to repeat it or something along those lines. And I think this kind of research is interesting because I think it could probably help modern scientists track long-term trends in environmental contamination into the future. I mean, we can see trends that happened in the past, whether they increased, and then, as you said, maybe 20 years after the EPA came into formation, it then decreased. What do you think future trends are going to show us?
Well, I think the future trends will show some ups and downs, and one of the things that it'll show is that there's some increases that are happening now that in some years we're going to say, oops, we shouldn't have allowed that to happen. And so we're going to have to clean these problems up. And when that happens, what we'll find is that certain parts of society will say it's too expensive and it's going to bring our country to our knees and we can't afford it. And that was certainly the case with leaded gasoline. That was the argument in the 1960s. It's too expensive. We can't do it. Well, we've done it. We've cleaned it up. We don't have lead in the gasoline anymore, and it wasn't too expensive. The same was true with the ozone problem, with the chlorinated fluorocarbons. Once the regulation was put in, then oops, somebody figured out how to come up with something else that would do the job just as well.
Point well made. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with University of Utah geology professor Ture Serling, and we're talking about lead exposure in hair follicles, an environmental archive in these hair follicles that have been collected from the early 1900s until 2024 in this particular research project. So gasoline consumption actually increased over time. Obviously, you know, population has increased. And, you know, if you look at the Salt Lake Valley, with the onset of the EPA regulations, for example, outlawing, making illegal to have lead in gasoline. So we now have unleaded. The exposure to lead plummeted, even though our gasoline consumption is up. So what other, you know, clean air amendments or EPA regulations took place during this time?
Well, there's a number of them. So, you know, one of the important ones was leaded gasoline. And for the people who aren't familiar with it, we used to put lead in gasoline to stop something called the knocking problem in internal combustion engines. And you say, well, how much was it? Oh, it wasn't very much. Oh, 2 grams per gallon. Oh, that's not much. That's a tenth of an ounce or something. But it turns out that we burnt so much gasoline, it was 2 pounds of lead per person per year, every year, for a long time. And that's a lot of lead. It just went up in the tailpipes and into the atmosphere. And it would attach to your hair if you're walking through the environment. So one of them was lead in gasoline. Another was what we put on much more stringent controls on power plants and smelters. That was mainly to address the issue of acid rain, but it also decreased things like mercury and lead and other bad elements that are in things such as coal. Another important one was in leaded paint. Lead was put in for two reasons. One is a colorant, and the second is that it was a fungicide. It would kill fungi so that things wouldn't grow on your paint surfaces. Well, if it's killing fungi, maybe it's not so good for us either. So leaded paint was also phased out about that time.
Mm-hmm.
Another important thing is lead has a very low melting temperature. And as a child, I know I made little soldiers out of lead that we made plaster of Paris molds and would melt the lead and pour it into these things. Well, obviously, that's not such a good thing. But because of that, it was present in solder. And there's a lot of pipes, water supply pipes in cities where it's still lead was used as a sealant. And and again, that's the previous administration put in some funds to help cities pay for cleaning up their lead pipe systems. Flint, Michigan is an important example of that in the last couple of years. So that's another example. We also put lead into cosmetic projects. There's certain cosmetics that lead is in. I mean, it's also in tattoo inks. And both of those could have higher regulations and perhaps lower concentrations of lead than we have. So there's a number of sources. There's one other important one is that in old buildings, especially government and church buildings and sort of civic buildings, it was often in the roofs of the buildings because it was a sealant to keep out water. And so when Notre Dame Cathedral burned down 5 years ago, it had a lot of lead in its roof, and the firefighters were exposed to high lead concentrations due to that. So there's many old buildings, especially, you know, built in the 1800s, often have lead in the roofs. And when they catch on fire, it puts lead into the atmosphere. So,
yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the crisis in Flint, Michigan, because that's very, very recent and very prevalent. And I think when we all heard the news of what it was doing to the children of, you know, the offspring of people who had ingested, you know, drunk water from these lead pipes for many, many years, it brought to light really the ongoing risks from lead contamination. And so right now, in the news very recently, we're actually, this administration is doing away with some of those protections, some of that regulation. Flint, Michigan would be a fine example that we all know of why we should have regulation. Can you talk a little bit to that if you're familiar with this?
I mean, I know, you know, only from the news stories, the Flint, Michigan situation, but, you know, it is just an example of that in the past, we would use this lead to stop leaks of water. And it, as I said earlier, the previous administration set aside quite a lot of money for cities to be able to, you know, change out their water distribution systems to get rid of that problem. And I believe in the last month that funding has been put on permanent hold. And so that's just another example of, you know, rescinding some of these environmental regulations that I think we've tend to forgotten. But the Flint, Michigan example is a very good and very recent example in that we have not cleaned up all of the problems that we know about, and also problems that we know how to solve. And that's an excellent example, one we know how to do it, and we should go ahead.
Dr. Serling, you had mentioned that the lead in gasoline was kind of spewing out the tailpipes and into the environment, the atmosphere, and there was some external exposure to hair follicles through the environment. And Lynn just mentioned Flint, Michigan, with the drinking water and the lead in the pipes. Is there any way to know when you're assaying these hair samples, what percentage, or is there a greater percentage of external exposure to lead or internal exposure to lead, like through the drink water versus, say, the exhaust pipes of leaded gasoline?
In our study, you know, we would have to do a lot more work to be able to get at that problem. But what I think it just shows is that the overall exposure to lead in the time from when your hair follicle grew to when you got that haircut, you were exposed to 100 times lower lead concentration now than, you know, before 1970. So it really is talking about the sort of that external, you know, the just your general environmental exposure.
Can you maybe speak to any type of the analytical techniques that your team used to measure the lead levels? How precise can these measurements be going back, 50, 60, 100 years on these hair follicles?
We're analyzing, only very small fragments of hair. We could probably do this on a single hair that was an inch long. We could measure the concentration, you know, well above background levels. So what we use is a instrument called inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry. A lot of words lumped together, but basically these samples would be dissolved in a strong acid and put into a flame where it's ionized. Actually at about 5,000 degrees, so about the temperature of the sun. And then we put it into an instrument that can just separate the different masses of the elements. And And this is done on the University of Utah campus, up on the fourth floor of the Sutton Building. It's an elegant, you know, an elegant measurement, but it, you know, if you, it, I think this study shows that it's actually not the sophisticated equipment; it's the getting the right samples that is the really tricky part for this study. Is how in the world do you get samples that are 100 years old?
It's quite an amazing bit of research. I'm wondering, Dr. Serling, if there's still measurable lead exposure here in Utah today. And, you know, we talk a lot about Great Salt Lake with the declining water levels there and the mercury-laden dust that's going to be blowing around. I do not know the relationship between mercury and lead. Will we be breathing more lead?
All right, I certainly would be breathing more lead because we were, you know, the sediments, the rivers and the waters were, you know, they're carrying lead into Great Salt Lake and into Utah Lake and other lakes. And so if those sediments are exposed, and we've done this, we've had a student, Nick Tiros, some years ago, who took some cores in Great Salt Lake. And what he showed is that, oh, wow, you know, 200 years ago, there was hardly any lead in the cores, and there's, you know, a lot more when you come to the modern. And we can see this in virtually any lake in the world. You can core the lake, and you go, you know, the older you get, the lower the lead concentrations. And you actually have to go back. If you have really good measurement methods, like with ice cores, you have to go back 2,000 years before you can, you know, before the human signal is gone. What this study does is bring it very much closer to home, because this is the, you know, it's actually the what we're measuring is what humans were definitely exposed to.
I may not have catched this, and you may have said it. Were all these hair samples from people between 1916 and 2024, say, all in the Salt Lake Valley?
Yes. All of these were in the Salt Lake Valley. I'll just say as an aside, some samples that we had were from outside of Salt Lake Valley because maybe as a child, the person didn't grow up in Salt Lake Valley, or maybe as an adult, they're not living in Salt Lake, but they're part of the study anyway. But as a child, they were in Salt Lake. So we have a number of samples that are from outside of Utah, and they were not part of the study, but they show the same trends.
This is so interesting. What is next in your research?
Well, in this particular project, I'm not really sure. Our original idea was that we would get maybe 1,000 samples, and we could actually begin to look at geographic distribution within Utah, but we didn't get that many samples. And, you know, so that would be an interesting thing to do, or to expand it to some other areas. And we might do that. So not really sure exactly what our next steps will be. It kind of, you know, may depend on the outcome of this radio show. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe this radio show is a call for more hair samples.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you joining us today on Cool Science Radio. Our guest has been University of Utah geology professor Tore Serling. And I just have to ask you something I've been thinking all along. It's interesting that a University of Utah geology professor is working on this research, and maybe what it shows is that you are no longer, like we say a lot, these different areas are no longer siloed. You're working together with, did you say it was Ken someone in the...
It was Ken Smith, and yes,
yeah.
Consumer Studies, and also up at the University Hospital. I used to play squash with him, so that's where.
Oh, there
you go. That was my connection to Ken. But in the geology department, we can analyze every element on the periodic table of the elements. We do. And so we have the instruments to be able to make these really high precision measurements at natural concentration levels. And so I think that's why in geology, sometimes we get involved in some of these other studies, is because we're interested in very precise changes in concentrations over a very wide concentration range, and being able to compare samples accurately that come from Africa or to North America and in different materials. So the analytical techniques are really not so much necessarily geological, but environmental, and the entire world is environmental.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I might say I also have an appointment in the biology department.
Oh, okay.
Probably should have said that sooner.
That might explain.
They might get mad at me for putting it here so late.
No, that explains a lot. Well, Trey, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, well, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Again, that was University of Utah geology professor with an appointment in the biology department, Trey Serling. Really interesting topic there. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.